to the sixth episode of our little podcast that we call Two Chairs Talking. My name is Perry Middlemas and my co-host is David Grigg. Hello, David.
Hello, Perry. How are you?
Not too bad after the wild and woolly weather that we had over the weekend. I got stuck out in it in the middle of Victoria when I was away for the weekend, and we lost power for 3 or 4 hours in an Airbnb place we were staying at up in the middle of Victoria, and it rained continuously yesterday and was freezing cold. But otherwise, had a really good day and a really good weekend.
Oh, that's good. It's nice to see a bit of rain anyway.
It is. It is. Now, I wanted to start off this episode, David, with a question without notice for you, because I always like throwing something at you to see whether how were you going to go. And my question to you this week is, are you a serial or parallel reader? That is, do you read just one book at a time or do you read a number of books all at once?
Usually I'm reading several books at the same time. Depends a little. I try not to mix too many fiction books at the same time. So I often have a non-fiction book going. I'm currently reading a book by Oliver Sacks. At night, I often have a couple of other books going. Maybe sometimes it goes up to five, but that's unusual. But it's usually certainly at least two, and often three or four. The other thing too is if I'm doing a production for Standard eBooks, then I have to proofread that book too. So that's like a project which is ticking away in the background often.
Yeah, so I could understand how that you have to keep on top of that one all the time. Do you find that if you're reading two novels at once, I find I can do that so long as they aren't actually in the same genres. If I'm reading, say, a hard science fiction novel, and I'm reading either a fantasy or a crime novel, I can keep the two completely separated without any problems whatsoever. But if I'm reading, say, two fantasy novels, which are reasonably similar, I'm done. I can't do that. They start merging into each other and I get myself a little bit lost.
Well, that can be interesting in its own right, can't it?
Oh, yeah, but then you can't appreciate one or t'other, can you, really? You basically don't know whether the good stuff in one novel's leaking over into the other one or the bad stuff is doing vice versa. So you get yourself a little bit a bit confused.
Yeah, certainly if I end up with too many books simultaneously, it can be a bit of a problem. But as you say, if you mix the genres, it's not quite so bad.
I was talking to my daughter about this today, and she asked me how many I was reading, and I told her, and she was a bit shocked. And I said, well, you know, as you said earlier, I mean, I'm going off to Iceland in a couple of months, and I'm reading a book. It's a travel memoir and a series of interweaved with a series of Icelandic myths and legends. And so that's really quite good. And that's completely separated from everything else. All of the myths and legends are basically in the middle of it, which I really like short stories. And so it's, again, you can very easily read an anthology or a collection of short stories while you're also reading one or two other novels. So it's quite possible to be able to reading four or five books at any one time. And still be able to handle it and enjoy it very, very well.
Sure. I read, I think, a fair amount of non-fiction, and so that makes life a lot easier. It's easy to keep non-fiction books separate in your head. So that works for me anyway.
Moving on to our major topic that we were going to talk about this week, we're going back to the Hugo Awards again, and this time we're going to deal with 1954. Now, 1954 is a bit of a funny year because it was a year in which originally in the night that would have been the 1955 Worldcon that would have given awards for the year 1954, there were no awards given because for whatever reason they just weren't given. And so sometime in the late or mid-1990s, in about 1996 exactly, the World Science Fiction Society, which is the non-profit organisation that oversees the Worldcons and the running of the Hugos, decided that it would be a good idea to be able to award Hugo Awards for those years in which a Worldcon did not give out awards. And so, basically, the awards for 1954, and did I say before that this was 1954 for a handed out in 1955? I think that was probably incorrect.
I think it was incorrect,
about, yeah. We're talking about 1954 for books and works that were first published in 1953.
Yeah.
But these are the 1954 Hugos. Anyway, the World Science Fiction Society decided that it would be a good idea to go back and, if you like, backfill all of those years that were not originally catered for. Now, they didn't want to do it all in one big hit. They decided they would do one at a time. And they set up a mechanism whereby they would allow a sitting Worldcon to be able to handle, to hand out what were referred to as retro Hugos for 50, 75 or 100 years for the anniversary thereof. And so the year that we're talking about here is 1954. The Worldcon in 2004 decided that they would take up this idea of giving out retro Hugos for the 1954 convention for works published in 1953. This has been ongoing for a while now, where not every convention has picked it up. I know that in 1999 we had the opportunity to award the 1949 retro Hugos, but decided that we wouldn't do so, probably on the basis of money, because it does actually cost a reasonable amount of money to get all the Hugo Awards together, but also the amount of effort it takes. These days it's a lot easier because things can be done over the internet a lot better, a lot quicker. You can do your checking a lot easier. But back in 1999, where for most people the internet was still in its infancy, it was a lot harder. And we just decided in that year that the people points that it was going to take were going to be too much for us to be able to do it. So we didn't. But anyway, a number of conventions have done so, have handed out these awards. In fact, the 1919 Dublin Convention is going to hand out the awards for 1944. And they are basically being voted on at the moment. Probably finishing the Hugo voting around about now, I think. So they will be announced and the awards handed out in August in Dublin. So that's how the retro Hugos work. So in essence, they're done almost exactly like the current Hugos, except that they are dealing with a period way in the past. And oddly enough, the interesting book that came up for the 1954 Hugo, handed out in 2004, was Fahrenheit 451. Have you read it, David?
Yes, I reread Fahrenheit 451 just recently for the purpose of the podcast, and it stands up pretty well. It's interesting in terms of being a piece of science fiction in that there's not a lot of new technology in it. It's really one of those pieces of science fiction which is really about changes in society or a social setup. I mean, there are some little things. They have full-sized video screens which take up a whole wall in the house. And in fact, they have a room which has got three full walls full of video screen. And the protagonist's wife spends a heck of a lot of her time sitting or lying there with earplugs in, the equivalent of what we would call these days something like the Apple AirPods in her ears, listening to conversations and listening to various shows, all of which seem to be incredibly vacuous and empty. And the point of the society, change in society, is that they've reached a point where books are seen as being a threat to the social order. And so they are forbidden. People are not allowed to read books. And in fact, if you're found to have a case of books in your house, the fire truck turns up. And the fire truck doesn't turn up to put out a fire, it turns up to set a fire, burning all your books. And so there's a few instances of that happening in the story. And the protagonist, whose name is Guy Montag, is a fireman, and he loves his job. He loves the smell of the kerosene that he sprays on the books, and the snap of the electric match that sets the fire off. But he's thrown out of his normal orbit by meeting a young lady on his way home. And the young lady talks to him and strikes up an acquaintance, and she has very liberal ideas, and he's kind of thrown off his normal course of things. And she asks him at one stage, "Are you happy?" "Am I happy? It's not something you thought about." And he goes back to his house, and his wife's lying there in bed with these little whispering things going on in her ears. But it turns out she's just taken a huge overdose, and he has to call the emergency department and have her taken away and her stomach pumped out. And the next day when she's back home, she has no memory of actually attempting to commit suicide. So things are not right in society. So it's an interesting concept, the whole idea that the books have become so dangerous that they're forbidden and that people are not allowed to read them, and in fact that there's an active process to dispose of books and to burn them up. And the whole course of the story is that following the protagonist as he goes through this arc of disillusionment from his job, disillusionment from the whole concept of burning books, and eventually to building up a little cache of books of his own and actually reading some of them and trying to convince his wife that there's something in these books to be read, that they might be worthwhile. And eventually he gets into all sorts of trouble, and the fire brigade turns up one day with him on board the truck, turns up to his own house, and from there things go downhill very rapidly, and he ends up fleeing the city. There's also a build-up to a war happening in the background, and by the time that he flees the city, there's actually a nuclear war is about to happen, and the city is eventually destroyed. And there's a whole nice thing at the end as to how books are being preserved even without the physical nature of the books. So I enjoyed it quite a lot. It's not all that profound a book, an idea, I suppose. There was a nice film made of it by François Truffaut, I think, in about the 70s, would that be right?
60s or 70s, yeah, I'm not sure exactly. Yeah. Right.
Which is nice in that there's actually no printed material at all in the film, including no credits, no textual credits, if I recall correctly. I was hoping to be able to see the movie again, but I haven't been able to get hold of an easy, accessible copy or to find the time to watch it. But it's not a bad movie. There's a more recent movie, I think, done in the 2000s, which I haven't seen, which I don't know whether how closely it sticks to the original story.
No, so again, I haven't seen that either. Yeah. So
No.
I was very taken by the way that the anti-intellectualism that had been obviously building up over the period leading up to this particular book influences the characters there, so that the society, I think we have to remember that this is it's depicting a possible future of really a forgotten past, or almost an alternative past. So many of the characters smoke. So many of the characters, you know, this communication isn't the way that we know of it as it is now. Now, that isn't to say that Bradbury was completely wrong about a whole heap of things, but there's a number of things you look at in it that just jar a bit when you read that when you read it now. In that, you know, all the people that are, everybody smokes, the men are more, it's sort of like a male chauvinist society. The women don't get as much free thought. They're not out working. It's the men that are working. So it's like basically a 1950s middle America transported sometime into the future.
I mean, that's only fair. That's what he was writing.
Absolutely. And I don't have a problem with it. It's just that it's something that has to be remembered when you're actually reading the book.
When you go
back
to it.
But if you look at it now and you look at that anti-intellectualism that went through in the lead up to the characters coming together for this particular book, so that that society is now in place where they burn books. And you look around at the moment with the fake news and the people not believing experts, you know, my gut tells me this is the way that it goes, or common sense would tell you this is the way that it goes. How dare you blind me with science and with facts? It just gives me something to think about. I don't want to think about that stuff. I know everything that's going on. And you sort of look at this and you think, yeah, well, actually, you can see bits and pieces of this happening already. So there are, if you put aside all those things like the smoking and the male-dominated society, but you look at the basic thrust of the book and the basic reason for the book, you start to see that he's very prescient in terms of...
I think he was. There's just a really nice passage in there which I found, which I thought was very prescient. And the guy Montag is talking to a chap called Faber, who's also an intellectual who is trying to preserve the idea of books. And he talks about how the media changed as he grew older. And there's this nice little passage, he says, where I remember the newspapers dying like huge moths. No one wanted them back. No one missed them. And the government seeing how advantageous it was to have people reading only about passionate lips and the fist in the stomach, circled the situation with you fire eaters, the firemen. But reading that, I'm thinking, well, here we are with all the newspapers dying like huge moths. That's exactly what's happening right now. Yep. So it was. I think that is pretty pressing.
Oh, I was just thinking also that I probably read this, like a lot of other Australians in the 1960s, I probably read this at high school because it was probably one of those books that was on the prescribed text for English literature or English during high school, and we were probably made to read it, and I probably didn't like this book at all. I could see my 14 or 15-year-old self, even though I was reading a lot of science fiction at the time, I would have looked at this book and thought, what the hell is this guy doing? I mean, I just don't understand this stuff at all. But now, reading it much later, you can understand all of the anguish that he goes through. You can see where a lot of the erosion of society's basic tenets, they've gone, and he's basically left adrift. He wants something. He doesn't know what it is that he wants. He can't understand what it is, and he can't understand how he can get it. And then he gets a glimpse of it through these interactions that you mentioned with the girl that he meets in the street, who seems like a wild child, for want of a better term. He thinks that she's a radical that is a free thinker, and her parents must be really weird and really strange, allowing her to say what she thinks. Why isn't she saying exactly the same as everybody else? And that throws him. To me, when I was, you know, probably 15 or 16, I'd probably thinking, what the hell is all this about? Would have made absolutely no sense to me at all. And again, we come to a book that we will do from time to time that we read in our teens and either dislike or like intensely, and then have a basically complete and utter reversal of opinion later on. Now, does that mean that our teenage opinion of the book was wrong? No. Does it mean our opinion now is right? No, it doesn't mean that either. It just means that our view of a book changes over time, which could only be a good thing.
Well, I mean, any book is a dialogue, isn't it? It's not simply the thing on the page. It's a dialogue between the writer and the reader.
Yes.
And as the reader changes, as we change in age, then the dialogue changes too. And so you get a different look at the thing, a different point of view.
It's also interesting that later on in the book, when he meets up with a number, he escapes from his house. And we're not giving spoilers here. The book's 50 years old. I mean, if you haven't read it by now, that, you know, basically, I'm sorry, but not much we can do about it. But anyway, he escapes from his house. He's on the run from the authorities who are trying to track him down, and he finds solace with a whole bunch of other people that have been ex-literature professors and lecturers, and he joins up with them, and he finds out that some of these men, and they are all men, again, have taken it on themselves to be the guardian of a particular book, where that is the book that they are going to be looking after, and they are the custodian of that book for eternity, so that later on when they get an opportunity, hopefully, to be able to republish the books, that this particular person will be the expert in that particular one. And while I was reading that, it actually struck me that there is a lot of number of similarities between this book and a book by Ursula Le Guin called The Telling. I'm not sure whether you have read this one.
No.
It's one of her Haynish Universe novels, where basically the concept is that the galaxy has been seeded by an ancient alien civilization that have set up human-like people all the way across the universe. And in one particular planet that a emissary of the ongoing galactic civilization organization called the Ecumen goes down to this particular planet and finds out that a similar situation has occurred there, in that books are completely banned all over the place, and that a group of radical, like-minded people have got together to store books up in the mountains so that they can't be found, and that each particular person has taken on themselves to be the custodian for one particular title. So it's quite interesting that something that happens back in the 1950s then comes back up again in the 2000s, or whenever it was that Le Guin wrote The Telling. And it's interesting to read the two of those together. So I'd recommend you have a look at that and see whether you can see the similarities in it.
Yeah, I must look that up. That sounds good.
Yep. So that was the novel that was handed out for the retros in 2004 for the to take over for the 1954 Hugos. And there was also a novella that was awarded. And the novella was A Case of Conscience by James Blish. David, I assume that you have read this recently as well, so as I have.
Yes, I've managed to find online a facsimile, a scan, if you like, of the original IF magazine in which the story originally appeared. And so I was able to read it literally in the original magazine. And the reason I did that is that A Case of Conscience, I started out as a novella and won the Retro Hugo for this particular year, but it eventually became a novel. And in fact, it won the ordinary novel in, I think, 1959.
The first novella takes up the first part of the book, I believe, and he wrote a second novella and put it on to the end of the book. So, if you like, it's what we refer to in the trade as a bit of a fix-up, but it's not. It's just two novellas put together and basically made into a novel. We talked about the lengths of novellas previously, how they're basically a short novel. So he's put two short novels together, where the second one follows directly on, or a few years later on, from the first novella, and made it all into one particular work.
Sure. So, but today we're just going to talk about the novella as a standalone piece. And it's an interesting work. It's based on there's a small team of humans who've been assigned to land on a planet and evaluate whether the people on the planet, the creatures on the planet, will be taken into the Human Federation, I suppose, something like that. But basically to give an evaluation of the value of the planet and what should be done with it, whether it should be thrown open to human involvement or close off. And one of the characters, the first one we meet, is a priest. He's a Jesuit priest called Ruiz Sanchez, I think is the chap's name.
That's it.
Yeah. And he is... as we first meet him, he's helping another member of the team who's fallen ill, and looks after him very well. And he retires, and he's working through some sort of curious theological case or a case study of something to be decided upon the ethics of a particular situation in a book, in a particular book. And we don't know what the book is at the start. And all the names of the people in the book have been transliterated into Latin names. So that's a bit of a curious little aside we get at the start. Anyway, he goes off because he's the other chap who's with him at the time has fallen ill. He goes off to try to send a message to the other two people who are part of the team who have gone off to a distant location on this planet. And he eventually discovers that the person who he's with, whose name is Cleaver, actually hasn't been sending any messages at all to the other team, which is a bit strange. The focus of the book is the people, the intelligent species on this planet, and they seem very intelligent. They have a different sort of lifestyle and different sort of biology than we do. They're kind of lizard-like, but they seem to have a very solid moral sense and a very sensible way of operating their civilization. And everything seems to come naturally to them. The things that we, moral sort of issues that we struggle with, they just seem to make the right decision by their very nature. What the priest eventually comes to the conclusion, that in fact this is a setup. This kind of civilization, this kind of species, can't be as good as they appear. They're too good to be true, if you like. And the eventual conclusion that it comes to and expresses to the other members of the team who are not priests and not religious is that this whole world is in fact a setup by the devil, by the forces of evil.
The devil referred to as the adversary in the book rather than the devil itself. Yeah.
Which of course is what the word Satan means, is the adversary. The others scoff and, you know, they don't think that this is much of a case. But eventually he does sort of persuade them that there is something odd about the way this planet is set up. And the whole moral dilemma of this planet is, according to the priest, is that it should be shut off from all contact from human civilization completely, because it would lead people down the wrong religious path. Because it seems to set up this perfect example of how one doesn't need God, one doesn't need Christianity to live a moral life, and that you don't need to take anything into consideration other than what appears to you to be good. So it's kind of an interesting story to be given an award in science fiction terms, I think, because I wonder how people react to it. How did you react to it?
Well, to me, I've got to basically come right out and say here that I'm basically completely a-religious, in fact, you know, sort of rampant atheist. And I have a bit of a problem with the whole argument that he sits down and puts to his fellow, this is Ruiz Sanchez, puts to his fellow investigators. Well, firstly, it seems very strange that these four people that are there are very ill-informed about what actually goes on in the planet. They're finding out stuff all the time that is of vital importance that they knew nothing about. And they appear to have been there for some period of time. I'm not sure how long, but some period of time. It's basically, Ruiz Sanchez bases his whole argument on the idea that this is part of the fight between good and evil. And in order for you to be able to accept his arguments, you have to basically go with the idea that there is a force in the universe called good and a force in the universe called evil. Now, I just don't believe that at all. I just don't see that at all.
But you can see that he believes that.
He believes it.
In his terms, it makes perfect sense.
Yes, it does. But it does. I'm not persuaded, of course, but that's just the way it is. He's putting an argument. He attempts to persuade the other three. I'm not sure that he fully convinces them totally. I think they come to the right conclusion in that they are going to seal it off completely, but for the completely and utterly wrong reasons, which I found rather amusing.
different reasons, really. There's the Ruiz Sanchez's reasons, and then there's the other reasons that one of the other people comes up. They don't decide. I mean, there's a split. They have to put it up for the four people.
Yeah, but Ruiz Sanchez comes to the conclusion that they're going to, he wants to have the whole planet completely quarantined and have absolutely no contact with it at all, because as he sees it, it's a complete and utter temptation by Satan to undermine, as you've stated, the whole of the religious community on Earth. It's a very interesting first contact book. I don't believe that there has been... I've never come across anything else ever like it in science fiction at all. It's certainly considered to be one of the major classic novellas in the field, and still holds up as a very, very interesting thing to read and talk about 50 years later.
I can think of a book, a more recent book, that is almost exactly in the same mode, and that's The Sparrow. The Sparrow.
Oh, yes.
Mary Doria Russell. Yeah.
Yep.
And that also has a Jesuit priest as the main character, who also visits another planet, which also puts up a huge number of moral issues for him. In this case, it's more about that character's own struggles with his own religion and his own belief in God, which is very severely tested in that book. That's another great first contact book, very much in the same vein, but not exactly the same, and exploring another interesting look at that whole idea of how religion survives the contact with another intelligent species, and how does the moral imperatives of your own religion work when you have a completely different species who hasn't gone through the Garden of Eden, hasn't fallen, hasn't had Christ come to save you from your sins. It's very interesting, but certainly The Sparrow is a terrific book. It's very harrowing, absolutely harrowing, but it's definitely a good book to read, and it is very much in the same vein as A Case of Conscience.
The Sparrow is very definitely on my to be read pile somewhere hidden. Yeah. And I'm going to have to get to that at some point.
There's a sequel to The Sparrow called Children of God, which is also not as good, but pretty good.
Yep. It's sort of interesting to read some of these things. You don't nearly get much of these religious moral dilemmas in science fiction. And when you do, they have a tendency to stand out because of their sort of uniqueness and the way they have to handle things.
Yeah.
And it's quite interesting, and certainly very, very worthwhile reading. And as I said, it's basically considered to be one of the major novellas in the history of the field.
Yeah. The other retro Hugos were given to, well, I'm not going to go through the whole list, but I think one of the other ones was to an artist, Chesley Burnstall, is that right?
Oh, yeah.
Yep. Yeah, I think that's right. He was a very well-known artist who did some wonderful astronomical paintings and really gave us the first kind of idea of what it might be like to stand on the surface of some of the planets and moons of the solar system in a not too unlikely sort of way. He knew his science, and there was nothing in that was fantastic. It was really, what might it be like to stand on the surface of Titan and look up at Saturn in the sky? Those kind of paintings. So it's just worth mentioning that he was one of the other retro Hugo winners for 1954.
Okay.
You're listening to Two Chairs Talking, a podcast hosted by Perry Milnes and David Grigg. Perry and I want to talk about a movie, which is a movie that came out in 2014. It's a film called Ex Machina. We've just had a little debate as to how you pronounce that. It is Ex Machina and not Ex Machina.
My joke, David, is that, you know, I grew up in country South Australia, and so not having heard much in the way of Latin at the time, and when I heard Deus Ex Machina, I always pronounced it because I only ever saw it read in print, and I had absolutely no way that I knew how to pronounce it. So for a long period of time in my head, it was always Deus Ex Machina, which completely wrong. But there we go. I'm happy to go to Ex Machina.
Okay. So it is, in fact, obviously from the full expression Deus Ex Machina, which means the god in the machine, which has a bit of a backstory we won't go into, but the full expression is Deus Ex Machina, God in the machine. Anyway, it's a movie, say 2014, directed by someone called Alex Garland, which was his first stint as a director. It features as actors someone called Domhnall, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly, Domhnall Gleeson, as a character called Caleb.
He's the son of Brendan Gleeson, who you might have come across from time to time, who's a major Irish actor. In fact, father and son both appeared in the last couple of Harry Potter movies together.
Ah, right. Very good. And the other characters are Oscar Isaac, who plays a character called Nathan, and there's another character called Ava, we'll sure get to shortly, who is played by Alicia Vikander. Now, the base of the story is that young Caleb, which is Domhnall Gleeson's character, young Caleb is an employee of a huge company called Blue Book, and it's a search engine. So think Google, think Facebook. It's really a combination of those things. Caleb has just discovered to his delight that he's won a competition. And the reward of the competition, the prize of the competition, is to spend a week on the estate of a character called Nathan, who runs Blue Book, who's the founder of Blue Book. And that's the Oscar Isaac character. And so off he goes and gets on in a helicopter and goes off. They're in the helicopter and he sort of says, oh, when do we get to Nathan's estate? And the pilot says, we've been flying over the estate for the last 2 hours. So it's this huge, huge area. And he's landed in a field and told just to walk along the path by the river to find his way to Nathan's house. And so he eventually does, and eventually meets up with Nathan, who he's seen before but has never had any personal contact with. Nathan is this combination of the worst aspects of Mark Zuckerberg, Elon Musk, and Steve Jobs, and a few others thrown in, I think. Just a really arrogant, self-interested sort of character who really wants to control everything. Anyway, he eventually he welcomes Caleb in, and they have a bit of a discussion, and he gets Caleb to sign this very long and detailed non-disclosure agreement, which Caleb's very reluctant to sign, but eventually he does sign it, and then Caleb reveals that he's been building, he's been trying to create an artificial intelligence. And Caleb thinks this is fantastic. If you can create an artificial intelligence, that's the history of not a history of man, but the history of gods is involved in that. We get to the point where we realize that Nathan's idea is for Caleb to test out this artificial intelligence and to go through a bit of a Turing test of the intelligence to see whether it really is an intelligent, new intelligence, and not just something which is faking the idea of being a computer intelligence, but a real artificial intelligence. And so Caleb is introduced to this robot. And he first sees her across a room behind a glass wall. And she has a beautiful face. This is Alicia Vikander. Beautiful face, but her body is, we can see through it. It's all mesh and lights, flashing lights and things. There's absolutely no doubt that this is a machine. But then he sits down and starts having a conversation with her, which is quite confronting to Caleb. She certainly seems like she is fully intelligent. And we go on from there, and then we start to realize that Nathan perhaps hasn't been quite honest with Caleb, and there's more going on here than he understands. In fact, it turns out, we found out after a while, that the whole competition was a fake, that he actually wanted Caleb to be the person who would come and do this sort of test.
Well, so basically, Ava carries on a long series of conversations with Caleb. Caleb's basically reporting back to Nathan every evening, and Nathan's basically trying to drink himself into a complete and utter stupor at the beginning of this film, and keeps on doing so. And you start to get to the feeling, as you pointed out, David, that Nathan is really very, very narcissistic. He is talking about controlling everything that happens with Ava. Caleb starts coming to the view that, yes, she really is an artificial intelligence, and then wants to know what is going to happen to her. Nathan starts talking about how, well, he's probably going to have to upgrade her. He's got to a certain point where he can't really go very much further with this. And if he upgrades her, he's pretty much going to have to completely wipe out Ava's personality and most of her memories. Caleb, by this stage, has got to the point where he's thinking that this is as close to another sentient human or artificial intelligence he's ever going to see. And he starts believing that this is tantamount to murder.
But the point is that he, by this stage, Caleb has fallen in love with Ava. He's absolutely enraptured by her as a character. And even though he knows that she's a machine, he can't help but be attracted by her, by the lovely face that she has and the way she talks to him. And so on. And there's no question that he's falling for her as though she were a human woman. And this is, Nathan is playing off this all the way through too. And you start to, is this deliberate? Does Nathan want Caleb to fall for this robot who looks like a woman? What's going on?
And then later Nathan actually puts it to Caleb that, how do you know that she is not actually playing you all the way through?
Yeah, that's,
you know,
right.
That she always wants, she's spoken about wanting to get out. Maybe she's going to be using you as a means to be able to get out of this situation that she's in. Have you thought about that? And I guess actually to the point at one stage where Nathan has Caleb so completely confused that he actually starts, he, that is Caleb, starts to doubt whether he is actually a human being or not either. He starts thinking, well, maybe I'm an artificial intelligence. So he actually gets a razor and cuts himself to see if he's going to bleed, and tries to see whether he can see anything down into his eyeballs or peel any of his skin off. And so it's quite an interesting film about what it is to be a human being and what it is to be a sentient entity. And so it's a very, very interesting examination of artificial intelligence and how it would be, how it would act and how it would interact with humans.
It's a psychological thriller though too, isn't it? Because you're constantly in doubt as to the motives, not
yes.
only of Nathan, but also of Ava. Has Ava fallen in love with Caleb? Does she feel affection for Caleb? He starts to think that she does. And is kind of plotting to run away with her, and then you get toward the end of the movie. We're going to give all these spoilers away, but never mind. You get towards the end of the movie, and in fact, Nathan tells Caleb that that's what he's been trying to do. He's been trying to see whether Ava can plan well enough into the future, and whether she can actually make a plan to escape by subverting Caleb, and that's what Nathan says that she's been trying to do, and he's really rapt because this is proof that she really is intelligent, that she's convinced you to help her escape.
But Nathan doesn't actually understand humans as well as he possibly should, and Caleb has undertaken some changes to the coding of the house while Nathan has been absolutely paralytic on the couch one evening. So he's changed all of the protocols for the house in terms of who can go where and who can get out. And a small power failure, which Ava has been initiating throughout the film, opens up all of the doors and she's able to escape. And Nathan suddenly realizes that while he thought he was controlling every single little avenue or every little single pathway of the exercise that he's put together, he suddenly found that something's happened that he wasn't planning. And then things don't work out terribly well for him.
Yeah, that's right. Well, it doesn't work out very well for either of them.
No, it does not.
Because Ava, in fact, has no affection for Caleb at all, as is proved by the way the film ends. She leaves him essentially to die and without a second thought, really. And so it's quite clear that that Nathan has created an artificial intelligence. It's bloody smart, and it's going to do things its own way. So it's a very interesting film.
It's certainly Nathan hasn't put Asimov's robotics laws in that, you know, that you're not allowed to, a robot shall not, through action or inaction, allow a human being to come to harm. That is not going to, that isn't in evidence here at all. So no. It's going to come back and bite him later on. But I was very interested to watch this film shortly after reading the novella A Case for Conscience, which we spoke about earlier, because both of them actually look at the question of what it is to be human, what it is to be intelligent, what it is to be a thinking individual entity that can make plans and aims to survive. It's quite good to be able to see the two of those in from completely different points of view, one being an alien intelligence and one being an artificial intelligence. Hardly recommend the film and also the novella earlier on.
That's the end of our sixth episode. We'll see you again in another fortnight. See you then. Bye.